ورحمة الله وبركاته.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi, alayhi salam, the 10th divinely appointed Imam. So, as we've been going, you know, slowly but surely and steadily through this very long conversation, this long dialogue of Imam al-Hadi, alayhi salam, which deals with one of the fundamental matters of confusion amongst the Muslims, not only in that era 1,000 years ago, but even in the present day, sometimes, you know, people have some trouble with this concept and they, you know, don't really realize what exactly is going on when it comes to compulsion and free will. Now, we again encourage the listeners to go ahead and go through the previous program so that you understand this idea and this question about whether it is absolute compulsion or absolute free will. Regardless, we have reached this place where we have been provided with enough proofs and evidences from Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam in this conversation, where His Eminence is saying that it is a matter between these two matters. It is neither absolute compulsion nor is it absolute free will. Now, at this point in the conversation, after all of these different stages have been set, you know, and these different proofs have been provided and these evidences against the listeners, should definitely go and listen to these episodes, we come to a point where Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam now starts to specifically talk about each one of them, right? He was setting the stage up to this point, and at this point of the conversation, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam says, "As for compulsion, it is the belief of those who claim that Allah forces people into committing sins and disobedience. And after Allah has forced people, compulsion, into committing sins and disobeying Him, then Allah punishes those individuals for that." Imam al-Hadi says, "Whoever believes in this concept has done an injustice against Allah. They have committed a wrong against Allah. They have falsified Allah Himself, and they have denied Allah's saying in the Holy Quran." Now, before we get into the verses of the Holy Quran, of course, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, in the previous programs we explained this, has said that the Holy Quran is the book which is the clear evidence for the believers. Of course, you have to have this comprehensive knowledge of the book of the Holy Quran in order to be able to come up with the correct understanding and the correct ma'arif and the correct teachings of Islam. So here, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he starts to talk about the different verses of the Quran. And of course, he has said that one who believes in absolute compulsion, jabr, says that Allah forces people into committing sins and then punishes them, and that this is definitely something that is an injustice. But the Holy Quran says, "And your Lord Allah does not deal unjustly with anyone." And then in another place, the Holy Quran says, "This is due to what your own two hands have sent before," meaning the sins that you committed. And on the Day of Judgment, it will be said to these people who committed sins that this is what your hands have sent before. Allah is not in the least unjust to the servants. And another verse of the Holy Quran where Allah says, "Surely Allah does not do any injustice to men, but men are unjust to themselves." And so again, an individual, Imam Hadi alayhi salam says, who claims that they have been forced into disobedience, they have ascribed their sins to Allah, and in this manner they have considered Allah unjust, and Allah does not have the right to punish somebody which He has forced them to do so. And so Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, in conclusion, he says that this kind of an individual he considers Allah as unjust and denies the Holy Quran, and whoever denies the Holy Quran is an unbeliever, and they are an unbeliever due to the consensus and the ijma of the whole Muslim Ummah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinians have taken to the streets across the occupied West Bank to protest against the Israeli genocide on the Gaza Strip as it nears 150 days. Despite the bad weather and heavy rain, protesters roam the streets of Ramallah chanting for Gaza and demanding an end to Israel's war on the besieged Strip. People here say that Israel is using the war on Gaza to escalate its military measures in the West Bank.
Despite the Israeli non-stop crimes against our people and attempts to break their will, the Palestinians there in Gaza are steadfast and the resistance is still fighting. Wherever the Palestinians are, they are facing the Israeli illegal plans and violence and the killing that is everywhere, settlement expansion, Judaization attempts, and now the Israeli plans of eviction and attempts to break the resistance in Gaza that all Palestinians are embracing.
Also, amongst the demands of the Palestinian protesters is to shed the light to the suffering of the thousands of prisoners incarcerated in Israeli jails under inhumane condition. In addition to the fact that the Israeli regime is using the illegal administrative detention that allows it to keep Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial.
Prisoners are being held under a disastrous situation in Israeli jails. 7,300 were detained from the West Bank and over 2,000 from the Gaza Strip since the 7th of October. And we should not forget that over 4,000 have already been imprisoned before. So we're talking today about over 11,500 prisoners who are being tortured, humiliated, and maltreated. Hundreds are in serious health condition and they're facing a slow death.
With all eyes are focused on the Gaza Strip, Israeli regime continues stepping up its violence here in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli forces shot dead 4 Palestinians in separate incidents in Al-Farah refugee camp and Tobas town, northeast Nablus, and at Mazmouria checkpoint near Bethlehem, bringing the number of Palestinians killed in the West Bank since the start of the war on Gaza to 411. Protesters today are stressing that no one is getting used to the Israeli genocide in the besieged Gaza Strip at the time when the regime's atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank are on the rise. They say this is the least they can do to express their anger, to express their support to their fellow Palestinians in Gaza, and to show them that they are not alone. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
As India prepares for the world's largest elections in a few months,
A research group has recorded alarming spike in anti-Muslim hate speech across the country. The US-based India Hate Lab said hate speech rose by 62% in the second half of 2023 in India compared to the first 6 months of the year. The states where most anti-Muslim hate speeches were recorded are Maharashtra, Uttar Pradesh and Madhya Pradesh. Considered the biggest voter bases of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, other states governed by BJP were not immune either.
It's actually all about the elections, as the ruling party want to retain the power. They don't want to lose this election. They are frustrating the largest Muslim community, and the minority has become an easy tool. They are distracting people from actual crisis the country is facing, and for them, provoking the religious sentiments of the people. Through hate speeches and targeting of Muslims have become election winning issue, especially for large political parties like BJP.
India Hate Lab says it compiled data of incidents reported by Indian media and tracked online activity of Hindu nationalist groups. In recent months, a similar research group, the Hindutva Watch, was blocked in India by a controversial Information Technology Act. Critics accused the ruling party of failing to address growing incidents of violence and hate campaigns against the Muslim community. They allege Modi's ruling party of stigmatizing critics using laws and enforcement agencies while distracting people from real issues facing the country.
Basically, the present government, who is at the center of the country, basically they don't have any issue related to the people. They don't have a development agenda. So they think that to divide the country on the basis of Hindu and Muslims and to polarize the Hindus, that the best tool is hate speeches. Unfortunately, all the people, those who are giving hate speeches, they are all related to Sangh Parivar.
As the largest minority group in India, Muslims have long been facing social, political and economic marginalization. Rights groups say India's ruling party BJP in recent years have also adopted various laws and policies that have legitimized violence against minorities. The groups allege that mistreatment of Muslims and other minority groups have grown exponentially under Prime Minister Modi, who assumed office in 2014 and is widely expected to retain power after the 2024 elections.
Elections are usually a thrilling experience for any democracy, which experts describe as a phase of transition for a nation's future in the right direction. Observers say in India, it's all about patronizing the majority by polarizing the voters, and religion plays a key role. They say the ruling party's newly enacted laws related to the minorities are turning detrimental for India's secular credentials. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The Yemeni Office of the Presidency organized the first political forum to discuss the political, security and strategic implications and dimensions of the Yemeni pro-Palestine operations in the Red and Arabian Seas. Political and legal experts, academics and researchers from Yemen and abroad participated in the event.
The Red Sea battle led by Yemen in support of the Palestinian people within the Battle of the Al-Aqsa flood goes beyond imposing a siege on the Israeli entity and its interests in the region. Yemen draws a new equation and a new reality for the region. Today, the situation has changed, and Yemen is leading a battle that will have major effects in the region and liberate the region from American influence.
Participants underscored the importance of bolstering Yemen's naval operations, which have proven effective in impacting the Western economy, and in particular that of Israel, amid its genocidal war on Gaza. They pointed out the significant decline in activity at Israel's Eilat port.
Certainly, the military operations in the Red Sea strongly affected the Israeli economy, and this is acknowledged by the Israelis themselves. The ports were disrupted, the prices significantly rose, and it led shipping and insurance costs for commercial ships also jump. And this was reflected in the stability of the prices of basic materials and commodities in the occupying entity. Israeli industries were also greatly affected, and the losses were not limited to the economic level only, but included the strategic level, to the point that many Israeli projects were stopped, such as the NEOM project and other projects.
Since the onset of the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, the Yemeni armed forces have carried out dozens of naval operations against Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, imposing a blockade on Israel's maritime navigation. Yemen's Defense Minister Major General Mohammed Al-Atafi has hailed naval reprisal operations against Israel, stressing that the era of hegemonic influence of the United States and its allies on international waters is over. Experts believe that the ongoing naval operations are not only a show of solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine, but also a move toward undermining U.S. influence in the region. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Syrian Journalists Union organized a central solidarity stand in support of Palestinian journalists at the General Organization of Radio and Television Building in Damascus. The stand was in response to a call from the International Federation of Journalists to observe a minute of silence in mourning for the journalist martyrs who were murdered by the Israeli occupation since the beginning of its war on Gaza. At 12 p.m., all media workers across Syria stood in silence for a minute, holding signs condemning the blatant Israeli aggression targeting Palestinian journalists and demanding an end to the aggression on Gaza and the West Bank.
This stand by Syrian journalists and media professionals is an expression of our complete and absolute support for the Palestinian Journalists Union, the Arab Journalists Union, and the International Federation of Journalists. It is a call to document the Israeli crimes against Palestinian journalists, as no other journalists in history have been killed in military confrontations like Palestinian journalists have been.
Syrian journalists affirm that Palestine is Syria's central cause, for which blood has been shed and sacrifices have been made. Today's stand aims to shed light on the systematic targeting of Palestinian journalists by the Israeli occupation, which has killed over 130 journalists since October the 7th. Participants praised the courage and sacrifices of their Palestinian colleagues who have replaced ink with their own blood in the pursuit of the just struggle and the honor of their profession.
These are the heroes who have been targeted by the occupation through assassination and bombardment because they have conveyed the truth about the massacres committed by the Zionist enemy. Today, Syrian journalists stand together in every newsroom, in front of cameras, and at their workplaces, observing a moment of silence, here specifically in front of the Syrian Press Martyrs Board, because the martyrs of truth are the beacons of light that illuminate the path of justice.
Syria has sacrificed dozens of journalist martyrs on the path of truth during over 13 years of its war against the terrorism supported by the West and specifically Israel. Today, Syrian journalists affirmed their unwavering support for their Palestinian brothers in their struggle against Zionist terrorism. Syrian journalists have gathered at this symbolic place in solidarity with their Palestinian counterparts who bravely resist the Israeli aggression with their words and cameras. They have unequivocally confirmed that the truth will prevail and justice will triumph. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
On Monday, the Hague-based International Court of Justice heard the final day of submissions on the legal consequences of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories since 1967. Over the 6 days of the public hearings, 52 nations and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the Arab League and African Union presented their arguments to the court. The first to speak on the final day of the ICJ hearings was the Turkish representative who joined a large number of nations condemning Israel's decades-long brutal policies in the Palestinian territories. Ankara pointed the finger at those nations which won't stop supporting Tel Aviv despite 30,000 innocent people have been killed in the Gaza Strip.
Those who should do it are well known. The Israeli supporters in the Security Council, it is their responsibility. Indeed, most of the international community is aware of this injustice and is trying to do something.
Palestinian representatives opened the proceedings on Monday last week by accusing Israel of having subjected Palestinians to decades of discrimination, leaving them with the choice of displacement, subjugation, or death. 2 days later, the UK asked the court not to offer an opinion at all on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation.
Unfortunately, the UK came with the political arguments, and here we are in a legal body. Unfortunately, their legal argument was very weak, and we believe that the court will dismiss it. The Israeli practices and measures and its presence in the occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful, and unlawfulness should have consequences.
This ICJ case was prompted by the UN General Assembly in December 2022, and it is different from another ICJ case filed by South Africa, which has accused Israel of genocide in Gaza. Outside the court, activists showed their support to besieged Palestinians during all days of proceedings.
There's also not an excuse for the other countries to say, well, we are not complying with this legal system that we all agreed upon.
I'm here to just show the support, to say to the whole world that the genocide should stop, and this is the only way actually to support our people in Palestine and Gaza.
The court is expected to issue its advisory opinion on Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories within 6 months. Despite having no binding force, the court's opinions nevertheless carry great legal weight and moral authority. However, it must be said, the ICJ has no enforcement arm. Max Civili, The Hague.
No picket lines over the weekend, but the strike action is on. Thousands of National Health Service junior doctors, who form half of the doctors' workforce in England, walk off the job. Their demands the same as the last time we talked to them.
Because of this erosion of pay over all this time, we've been seeing problems with staff recruitment and retention, and we've been hemorrhaging people either out of medicine completely or to other countries that are willing to recruit us and pay us basically the rates we were being paid 15 years ago. And so the message from the BMA has always been to try and get that pay back to 2008 levels.
In other words, a 35% pay rise to make up for previous below-inflation pay rises. An extra 3% on top of the average of nearly 9% received last year was being discussed before talks between the government and the BMA, the trade union for doctors, broke down in December. But the walkouts come at a cost. They're happening at a critical time of year when hospitals are especially busy dealing with the challenges of the cold season and with an NHS waiting list at a staggering 7.6 million. Over 1.3 million hospital appointments had to be rescheduled since the industrial action began over a year ago. And yet, the striking doctors continue to enjoy the support of over half of Britons.
The doctors say they're doing this to bring the government back to the negotiating table and to get it to recognize their value. They're also saying that feeling undervalued and being underpaid is pushing them to seek jobs abroad.
The BMA says 4 in 10 doctors plan to leave the NHS at the first opportunity. The government says it won't negotiate while the strikes are ongoing.
There's an overall focus on privatization, which means the health care insurance companies will be taking over many aspects of the running and resources of health. And that's led to record low wages, especially compared to a massive inflation and cost of living crisis, so that it no longer justifies the cost of training in terms of the actual remuneration. Medical students are leaving with medical school with £100,000 worth of debt, and they're not looking to pay that off for well over a decade. Whereas if they go to other countries simply next door, Ireland or Australia, they can immediately double their wage.
The British government seems nowhere near loosening its purse strings. But the consensus is that the longer these strikes grind on, the wider the damage. Saipur is up, London.
People are preparing for the Friday's elections, in which they will vote for their representatives in Parliament and Assembly of Experts. Thousands of candidates, including women and the young generation, are vying for the seats.
Nearly 15,000 candidates are running for the election. Of these candidates, 12% are women and 63% belong to the young generation, which includes young activists aged between 30 and 50 years old.
Islami also mentioned different political groups and parties that are participating in the upcoming elections.
All of the country's political spectrums, including principalists, reformists, and independents, are among the candidates. A close contest is underway among them in the country's different zones and cities. According to the law, the parties can support a list of candidates as well as introducing their intended candidates.
In the meantime, 200 local channels have been launched for the candidates' election campaign.
The IRIB has launched 200 local channels and the candidates can use them for their campaigns as well as the radio and social media.
Nearly 40 elections have been held in Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which is a symbol of people's power and presence in the country's sensitive occasions. Iranians across the country will participate in the elections as they see choosing their representatives both in the parliament and assembly of experts as a duty to maintain the basis of religious democracy in their country. Farzan Ashuryun, Tehran.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
در چه صورت نعمت ها میتونه ما رو به خدا گره بزنه پل بشه ما رو به خدا برسونه
How the blessings of Allah can get us closer to Allah How the favors of Allah can be like a bridge between us and Allah This happens when you use the blessings of Allah and you recognize from whom such blessings are sent down Blessings are tied with Allah through giving thanks. Using blessings of Allah without thanking Him becomes an obstacle on the way of knowing Allah. In better words, without thanking Allah, the blessings do not get you closer to Allah. The late Mirza Rahim Arbab, the famous Iranian mystic, used to clean the vegetables very much softly and with taking much care. when he was asked about spending so much time for cleaning the vegetables, he said, "I fear that on the Day of Judgment I am asked by an unnoticed leaf of vegetables that why didn't you let me enter the body of a believer so that I get perfect too?" This means that even a leaf of vegetables can get to higher degrees if it enters the body of a believer who is thankful to Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of Arab English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.ir Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, leading doctors have said more than a third of cancer patients in England are facing potentially deadly delays, with thousands of people forced to wait months to begin their treatment. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Research has revealed cancer patients in the United Kingdom wait up to 7 weeks longer to begin radiotherapy or chemotherapy than people in comparable countries. The stark findings are yet more damning evidence of the extent to which the United Kingdom lags behind other nations, as experts warn that people's chances of survival are being affected by long waits for treatment. In the first research of its kind, experts at University College London analysed data from more than 780,000 cancer patients diagnosed between 2012 and 2017 in four comparable countries: Australia, Canada, Norway, and the United Kingdom. Eight cancer types were included: esophageal cancer, stomach cancer, colon cancer, rectal cancer, liver cancer, pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, and ovarian cancer. The two studies, published in Lancet Oncology, were the first to examine treatment differences for 8 cancer types in countries across 3 continents. The research found British patients experienced the longest waits for cancer treatment. The average time to start chemotherapy was 48 days in England, 57 in Northern Ireland, 58 days in Wales, and 65 days in Scotland. The shortest time was 39 days in Norway. In radiotherapy, Britain fared even worse. It took 53 days on average for treatment to begin in Northern Ireland, 63 days on average for treatment to begin in England, 79 days on average for treatment to begin in Scotland, and 81 days on average for treatment to begin in Wales. In Newfoundland, Canada, which had the best record, the average wait was 42 days. Compared with Newfoundland, waits for radiotherapy in Northern Ireland were 11 days longer. In England, it was 3 weeks longer, and in Scotland and Wales, it was 7 weeks longer. The research also found that in the United Kingdom, a lower proportion of people with cancer were given chemotherapy and radiotherapy than in other countries. 59% of ovarian cancer patients in the United Kingdom received chemotherapy, compared with 67% in Canada, 72% in Norway, and 73% in Australia. The same was true for pancreatic cancer patients, 27% in Britain, compared with 41% in Canada, 44% in Norway, and 47% in Australia. The study showed that older patients were the least likely to receive chemotherapy and radiotherapy treatment, particularly in Britain. For example, 2% of UK patients aged 85 and over received chemotherapy, compared with 8% in Australia and 14% in Ontario, Canada. Although not all patients need them, chemotherapy and radiotherapy are key treatment options. The International Cancer Benchmarking Partnership research found countries with better cancer survival rates typically made greater use of chemotherapy and radiotherapy and had shorter waits for treatment. Cancer Research UK, which part-funded the 2 studies, said delays to begin treatment were partly a result of the British government's lack of long-term planning on cancer in recent years. It said countries with robust cancer strategies backed by funding had seen better improvements in survival rates. The charity said the National Health Service workforce crisis was also a barrier to delivering treatment as far as cancer patients were concerned. Michelle Mitchell, its chief executive, said, "When it comes to treating cancer, timing really matters. We can learn a great deal from other countries who have stepped up and substantially improved cancer services. With a general election on the horizon, the British government has a real opportunity to buck the trend we see in this research and do better for people affected by cancer." Dr. John Butler, a cancer surgeon and clinical lead for the International Cancer Benchmarking Partnership, said, "Lower use of chemotherapy and radiotherapy in the United Kingdom could impact people's chances of survival, especially for older patients." He said cancer survival in the United Kingdom remained about 10 to 15 years behind that in other countries, adding, "This study captures missed opportunities for patients in the United Kingdom to receive life-prolonging treatment." The Department of Health and Social Care said it had invested significantly in cancer care since the period covered by the research, including £162 million on radiotherapy equipment and £2.3 billion on community diagnostic centres. A spokesperson for the Department of Health and Social Care claimed, "Survival rates are also improving across almost all types of cancers." Twitter website, Press Reader, has also covered the same story and tells us more. Leading doctors have said more than a third of cancer patients in England are facing potentially deadly delays, with thousands of people forced to wait months to begin their cancer treatment. According to the latest performance data for England, there has also been a significant surge in people experiencing long waits in accidents and emergency departments, though officials claim the overall National Health Service waiting list continues to fall. Doctors raise concerns that cancer targets across the National Health Service were still being missed, even when somebody has been diagnosed with the disease, with one vital target now not hit for 8 years. The proportion of patients waiting less than 62 days in December from an urgent suspected cancer referral or consultant upgrade to their first definitive treatment for cancer was 65.9%, up slightly from 65.2% in November. The target is 85% and was last met in December of 2015. The figures emerged in the same week that Britain's King Charles III began treatment for cancer within days of being diagnosed. Buckingham Palace has not specified whether the King is receiving private healthcare or being treated under National Health Service. While he's already receiving expert care, his treatment has drawn further attention to the long waiting times in the National Health Service. Professor Pat Price, a leading NHS oncologist and co-founder of the Catch Up with Cancer campaign, said, "Today's National Health Service data shows that more than a third of cancer patients face potentially deadly delays. In December, 7,661 cancer patients waited more than the maximum recommended 62 days to start their cancer treatment, with 2,227 waiting 3 months or more. Meanwhile, the data showed hospitals remained under pressure. The number of people waiting more than 12 hours in accidents and emergency departments from a decision to admit them to actually being admitted to hospital hit 54,308 in January, up sharply from 44,045 in December. This is the second highest figure on record.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Qadamiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahruddin was.
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan,
Maulavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Quran.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly life of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries, scholars, and ulama during the history of Islam. I am Ata, the host of this program. Two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, two Islamic scholars, are invited to today's episode of the program, The Teacher, Shaykh Rouhani. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Shaykh Khadai, salam alaikum to you.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about another outstanding dignitary of the Shiite world, among the most outstanding fuqaha of the fiqhi jurisprudential school of thought in the city of Isfahan, Hakim, during the Safavid era, a master of philosophy and hikmah, Hussein ibn Jamaluddin Muhammad Khansari, mainly known as Muhaqqiq Khansari or Agha Hussein Khansari. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life and biography of Agha Hussein Khansari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Al-Muhaqqiq al-Khansari was a jurist, actually, from the Fiqh school of Isfahan. He was a Shia, also theosophist, in Safavid period, in 11th century, who was knowledgeable in philosophy, theosophy, rational studies, and traditional sciences. He was actually first interested in kalam, in theology and philosophy, but later turned to fiqh and usul.
Yes.
And became famous in them to be the, let's say, scientific and religious leader of his time. He passed away in Isfahan and was buried in, let's say, Takht-e-Fulad Cemetery.
Yes.
Of Isfahan. When it comes to his life, of course, Khansari was a scholar in fiqh and let's say great Shia theosophist in the Safavid period.
Yes.
So before he reached the age of maturity, he went to Isfahan to acquire Islamic knowledge and began his studies in the seminary of Khaja Malik,
yes,
which was the, let's say, forum of great men of knowledge at that time. He benefited from many teachers, and thus, actually, he called himself Tilmidh, Tilmidh al-Bashar,
yes,
to refer to the multitude of his, let's say, teachers. Agha Hussein actually perfected his rational knowledge before Mirfan Rizki, and traditional sciences in the presence of Muhammad Taqi al-Majlisi.
Wow.
And okay, received, let's say, permission for the hadith transmission from him. Other teachers listed as his teacher are al-Muhaqqiq al-Sabzawari, author of the Al-Dhakhira,
yes,
and the, let's say, An-Haydar bin Muhammad al-Khansari,
yes,
author of, let's say, Zubdatul Tasanif.
Yes.
Although he suffered actually poverty during the his education, he reached the level of Sheikh, or let's say he actually reached a level Shah Sulaiman Safavi sent him his, let's say, own precious clock.
Yes.
And in one of his, let's say, travels, appointed him as his vicegerent.
That's right.
To deal with the affairs of the state. Having such a great position and all the, let's say, comfort he had, Agha Hussein was always a refuge for the miserable and, let's say, the needy and the poor people. He was, of course, knowledgeable in rational and traditional sciences.
Yes.
And according to Al-Fadl Al-Isfahani, he was the support for men of knowledge.
That's all right. Okay, thank you very much for beautiful, complete, and comprehensive introduction to Agha Hussein Khansari's life. Al-Ustad al-Kol fel-Kol was the title Sheikh Fadai used for this outstanding man. And it seems that the city of Isfahan at that time, again, was the flourishing site, it's better to say, for such a scholar. So many people from all around Iran and the Persian lands on that time migrated to the city of Isfahan to benefit from the teaching courses of the time. So we can consider Isfahan, beside Qom and Mashhad and Najaf on that time, and the Hawza of Isfahan as the strong ones, isn't it? So for today, maybe it is not that much as strong as Najaf and Qom or Mashhad are, but it seems that in the past, on that time, especially in Safavid era, it was the strongest Hawza of the world, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, it is like that. We had different hawza all around the Islamic regions. And now I remember a sentence from our Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. He said, hawza is like a living being.
Mm-hmm.
It has a birth and it has a death.
Mm-hmm.
We had some hawzas like Hilla, that nowadays we don't have something much from,
yes,
the Hawza of Hilla.
Yes.
And then at that time that we have Hawza of Hilla, we didn't have any Hawza in Qom.
Yes.
But then Hawza of Qom was born. And Isfahan was like that. At the time of Safavid, in the Safavid era, Hoza of Isfahan was one of the most important Hoza in Islamic region. And at that time, Hoza of Qom was not such important and powerful.
Yes.
But by passing time, the Hoza of Isfahan didn't die, mm-hmm. but couldn't remain as powerful as it was. Yes. And then the power of science was moved to Hoza of Najaf and then to Hoza of Qom. Yes. And now. And one of the significant points in the life of our great scholars like Ayatollah Khansari, Muhaqqiq al-Khansari, as you mentioned, is that they used to grow a lot of students.
Yes.
At that time, our great scholars, they believed that this is their duty to grow good students. As we can
see,
so I mean,
nurturing students, generation after generation, was a responsibility of the ulama.
It was a responsibility. Okay. As you can see in the history record of Muhaqqiq al-Khansari, they say that most of the scholars of Hoza of Shia, mm-hmm. most of them were the students of Muhaqqiq al-Khansari, directly yes. or indirectly.
Yes.
You know, this is a very good title for someone to call it Ustad al-Kul.
I've got some names over here. Just look at the names. We can say Agha Jamaluddin was the famous son of him, Sayyid Nematullah Jazaili, Mirza Abdullah Afandi, Muhammad Hassan Hurr al-Ameli, Muhammad Saleh Khatun Abadi, Muhammad ibn Abdul Fattah Tunukabani, and so many other outstanding students, we can say, were nurtured by this outstanding man. Okay.
And it should be like that.
Yes.
Of course, I don't say that no one yes. is like that here today.
Yes, yes.
But
today
mostly,
we have also the courses.
Yes, we
you
have.
Know, yes, yes.
But mostly we forgot. Mm-hmm. This tradition
of
this
nurturing.
Is our responsibility uh-huh. to nurture more students.
That's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, what about his outstanding works?
Yes, when it comes to the works of this great scholar, we can mention some of them briefly. The most important work of this great scholar is Mashariq al-Shumus fi Sharh al-Durus, is his famous work in fiqh, which is a commentary on Kitab al-Durus written by al-Shahid al-Awwal.
Al-Durus al-Shar'iyya, that's
yeah,
right.
Al-Shar'iyya fi Shaykh al-Awwal, Shahid al-Awwal. So, Abu Abdullah Muhammad ibn Makki al-Amili. So, this book is unfinished and Aqa Hussein could not finish the details of this discussion, mm-hmm. of the discussion regarding the information about Imams, alayhim salatu wasalam, and discussions on 12 Shia fiqh
yes.
scholars in every topics. But according to the author of Rawadat al-Jannat, this book is rare regarding the volume of research, and this book has been published in Tehran two times in 305 yes. and 311.
So in all the works of these outstanding scholars, you could find a work on fiqh, you know,
yeah.
or shari'i sciences yeah, or shari'i knowledge. That's right. Okay.
Yeah. And then the other work that we can mention here is that Al-Risala fi Muqaddamat al-Wajib.
Mm-hmm.
It is also published about the manuscripts. There are a lot of manuscripts are there over there that we can just mention some of them. For example, Hashiyatul Isharat, which
yes.
is a kind of interpretation, explanation. Again, Al-Isharat means notes. And then marginal notes on, let's say, Al-Ilahiyat.
Yes. Isharat is a book by Avicenna,
isn't it? Avicenna,
yes. Shafa yes, also of Avicenna.
Ilahiyat Shafa is also there. That
yes.
Notes on Al-Shafa, there's Risala, let's say, Al-Ijma. Again, it's a fiqh and jurisprudential Risala mm-hmm. or treaty. And of course, there's another book by the name Insha, which means composition, on the prohibition of drinking alcoholic drinks. It is a kind of jurisprudential treatise.
That's right.
And of course, then we have another Insha composition on description of spring.
Yes.
And then we have Ta'rif al-Sukhan. Ta'rif al-Sukhan. And then we have marginal notes on Sharh al-Tajrid. Sharh al-Tajrid is one of the very great theological sources written by late Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi. And then he had a marginal note on Mutawwal. Mutawwal is about literature, Arabic literature. And then he had another book in Suhbat al-Tafra. Then the solution of questions about division of things to infinity. Marginal notes on, let's say, muhakimat, and marginal notes on, let's say, mukhtasar al-usul.
Yes.
You see that when it comes to his works, we have another fa'ida on the knowledge of God, the Almighty.
Yes.
Look at these manuscripts that deals with different subjects and different fields of studies.
Very good.
At least theology, philosophy, mysticism, usul, fiqh, jurisprudence, you know, hadith, tafsir.
Yes.
It shows that how much a great scholar he had been in his time, that he was a professional scholar in all these different fields of studies that could be termed as one of the great teachers of Islamic Hausa in the history of the Shayu.
And the interesting point is that most of the outstanding libraries of Iran, whether religious or the national ones, benefit from the manuscripts of this man, the outstanding manuscripts, which are considered among the Shiite legacy during the history of the Shiite world. Okay, as we said, he's passed away in the city of Isfahan. His body was taken into Takht-e-Pulat Cemetery. There is a tekia, or it's better to say mosque-like or a Muslim-like place belonging to Khansari families over there in Takht-e-Pulat. He is buried over there. Agha Jamal Khansari, another outstanding figure. His son, in fact, is also buried beside the father over there in Takht-e-Pulat Cemetery in the city of Isfahan. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, Agha Hussein Khansari, mainly known as Muhaqqiq al-Khansari. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Fadai, for a nice elaboration regarding the life of this outstanding man. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us and the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstudy.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode and introducing another outstanding Shiite dignitary and a scholar, God bless you all. Fi aman.
A teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.